Hello and welcome to History 281, Republican Latin America at the University of Northern British Columbia. My name is Dr. Benjamin Bryce. This is the first of 12 podcasts that offer an overview of modern Latin American history. They're accompanied by readings of Teresa Mead's textbook, A History of Modern Latin America, 1800 to Present. Students at UNBC will also attend class to discuss assignments and research projects, but not to attend lectures. And other listeners can check out the course syllabus at benjaminbryce.ca. Today's podcast is on the topic of independence in Spanish America. Today I'm going to talk about four points. First, Spanish America as it existed in the immediate, on the eve of independence, so around 1790. My second point are the external causes of independence. And then my third point is the road to independence. And finally, some of the outcomes, key ideas, leaders, and dates of those wars of independence. Before going any further, a couple of important conceptual points to think about independence movements, in this case in Spanish America, but you can make this more broadly about independence in the Americas from the late 18th century into the late 19th century as it took place in various parts of the Americas. So independence in Spanish America was about achieving something new. Before independence, there were no nations, so the republics that finally emerged after independence were not the same as the political system that existed before. And those republics that existed afterwards were not the natural outcomes of the political order that existed before. So it's in the aftermath of independence that something new is being created. Looking back, these colonial origins of different nations become part of the myth of nation building. But in the moment, that is not how people and the actors of these wars of independence saw it. These new republics that are created across Spanish America, or in the ashes of the Spanish Empire in the Americas, become some of the oldest nation states in the world. So by 1900, 17 of the 53 countries that existed in the world were in Latin America, and they were the outcome of these early 19th century wars of independence from Spain. Engaging with a different set of ideas, another important point to mention is that the republics that emerged, what end up being 17 republics in 1900, were not a failure. Not creating one or four mega countries out of Spanish America, not creating a single Spanish America sort of in opposition to the United States, that's not a failure. These countries, it's only sort of a nationalist lament that Argentina or Colombia or Mexico are not as big as the United States. But the creation of this a variety of republics out of four Spanish viceroyalties should not be thought of as a failure, even though it often has been in the past 100 years. So to my first point about Spanish America. As a point of departure, I want to flag that this is a Eurocentric and simplistic term. Spanish America in 1800 or in 1790 is coexisting with indigenous America that existed throughout the colonial period. Spanish authority in a large part of the territory that we're calling here Spanish America, and you could see in a map, the map of Spanish America, Spanish authority was not absolute. Millions of people had only intermittent contact with either the Spanish crown or the Catholic Church. So to call this Spanish America is only representing one viewpoint, and it's a very tenuous Spanish America in many senses of the word. So the republics that ultimately do emerge over the course of the 19th century and that come out of these wars of independence from Spain, in many ways are anchored in four traditional political, a traditional political geography of the Spanish Empire in the Americas, that Spain and these territories that Spain had created over the course of 300 years of colonization were called viceroyalties. So they were subordinate to the king and run by a viceroy. The first one, the oldest viceroyalty, was called New Spain, which makes up the territory mainly of modern day Mexico, and was founded in 1535. The second one, very soon after, is Peru, founded in 1542. And these two viceroyalties, built on the centers of the largest populations of the Americas that Europeans encountered in the 16th century around central Mexico and central Peru, became the core sources of power and of wealth for the Spanish crown over the next 250 years. In the 18th century, two new viceroyalties are created in areas where the Spanish crown is expanding its authority, what was already called nominally Spanish America, but in the creation of new viceroyalties, there's a sort of greater infiltration of Spanish influence, Spanish commercial ties, Spanish political and military power into new areas of South America. The first one is created in a few steps between 1717 and 1739 in northern South America around present-day Colombia, Venezuela, and Ecuador. It's called New Granada. And the final viceroyalty created very much at the very end of the colonial period out of a territory that Spain actually did have a lot of influence over through trading routes, but this is a cementing of Spanish colonial power in the Rio de la Plata or River Plate region around Buenos Aires and Montevideo, so around present-day Argentina, Uruguay, and also to an extent Paraguay and Bolivia. And that is founded in 1776. So there are two viceroyalties created in the early and mid 16th centuries, and then two more viceroyalties created in the 18th century, in the New Granada in the early 18th century and Rio de la Plata in the late 18th century. It is out of these four viceroyalties that political agitation emerges after the turn of the 19th century, and from where wars of independence are launched. And there is a loose idea that perhaps these four viceroyalties could become four republics, but very quickly these republics shrink in size. So New Spain and Peru continue to be the centers of Spanish sources of income and sources and sites of Spanish political power in the Americas right up to the Wars of Independence. By 1800, 40% of the people living in Spanish America lived in New Spain, in the area of what is now present-day Mexico. And so there's certain viceroyalties, particularly New Spain and to a slightly lesser extent Peru, that are more important than two other viceroyalties, which is New Granada and Rio de la Plata. At the same time, these two new viceroyalties, Nueva Granada or New Granada and Rio de la Plata, are emerging in terms of their political and economic importance. The way the Spanish colonial system worked is that there's a ruling elite, which are either peninsulars or creoles, and they make up about 25% of the population in these four viceroyalties. Peninsulars are people born in the Iberian Peninsula, more precisely Spain. So they are Spaniards spending a period of time in the Americas, playing an important role in the political, military, and economic order of these Spanish colonies. Creoles, and this is a distinct Spanish-American use of the word, not to be confused with Creole languages of the Caribbean, or Creole as talked about in Spanish America and as it comes from the Spanish word criollo, are people of Spanish heritage born in the Americas. So that's to say there are people of other heritages, of indigenous and African heritage or mixed heritage living in the Americas. They are not Creoles. Creoles are the people who are the children of Spanish elites, largely living in Spanish America. And they cannot ascend as high in the social order as peninsulars because of their status of being born in the Americas rather than being born in Europe. So these are these two groups of Spanish peoples governing Spanish America, the peninsulars and the Creoles. And these two terms, peninsulars and Creoles, will come up again later today. The vast majority of people living then in Spanish America were of indigenous, mixed, or African descent. The Spanish viceroyalties, their colonies were shaped or defined by large estate owned by white landowners, these landowners of Spanish heritage or Spanish birth. They depend highly on exploitative labor relations, whether it's on exploiting indigenous or mestizo laborers or slavery, depending where in Spanish America. It's either an economy reliant on a large indigenous population or reliant on an imported slave population or the descendants of an imported slave population. There are different economic activities that take place in different parts of Spanish America. So sugar is the central thing being exported and being produced in places like Cuba and Puerto Rico. Mining is an important industry in both Peru and Mexico. Cattle is an important industry in places like Mexico and Argentina. So depending where in Spanish America, there are different economic activities, and there are then different systems of labor relations, all of which are exploitative and all of which are to the benefit of Spanish-born or Spanish-descended people, the Peninsulars or the Creoles. Now to my point, my second point, the external causes. Spanish American independence is part of a broader transformation in the Atlantic world in this time period. It's part of what historians call the Revolutionary Atlantic. It's influenced by the American and French revolutions, and very importantly, it's worth stressing also the Haitian Revolution. And one thing that is actually tied to both the French Revolution and the Haitian Revolution are the Napoleonic Wars taking place in Europe in the late 19th and early 18th and early 19th centuries. This is the Revolutionary Atlantic, and Spanish-American independence emerges out of this revolutionary spirit and times and circulation of ideas, upending a previous colonial order that defined the Americas for the previous 250 years. So the first external cause I want to talk about are the American and French revolutions. The ideas of the American Revolution, this liberal republicanism, changing ideas of governance and bringing in ideas of sort of a broader political representation for more groups of people beyond just a single monarchical system and very small circle of lords and people related to the monarchy, expands to a group of affluent men who have a broader democratic involved participation in the governance of their emerging societies. And merging these ideas of liberalism, which also have an important trade component and free trade and not a confined trade network only between the imperial metropole and its colonies, so liberalizing of trade relations, is merged then with another idea of republicanism, which is sort of in opposition to a monarchical state that is defining the colonies and the European colonizers. These ideas that emerged first in the American Revolution in the 1770s and 1780s become important points of inspiration for Spanish Americans and the entire political system that is created by in the post-independence United States in the 1880s and 1890s becomes a model for the republics that are created in Spanish America after 1810 and in the 1820s and 30s. The second major revolution that takes place in a very similar time period to the American Revolution is the French Revolution. It affects both Haiti, an important part of the Caribbean, and therefore very closely connected to important parts of the Caribbean controlled by Spain, so Puerto Rico and Cuba. And the French Revolution also affects Spain directly through the Napoleonic Wars. The French Revolution embodied liberal ideas of liberty and equality for men, or elite men in many ways. And these ideas of the French Revolution also have an important idea on the new republics and the liberalism that takes hold in the early 19th century in Spanish America. The second external cause is the Haitian Revolution. It's a slave revolt in a French colony in the immediate aftermath of the start of the French Revolution, which starts in 1789. By 1791, the ideas of liberty and equality are spreading from the French Revolution and from metropolitan France to Haiti, and inspires what ends up being a successful slave revolt over the course of the 1790s, ultimately leading to Haitian independence in 1803. That Haitian Revolution plays a role in shaping elite responses to independence elsewhere in the Americas, and particularly elsewhere in the Americas dependent on slavery and sugar, the sugar economy, and particularly in places in the Caribbean such as Cuba and Puerto Rico. So in this history of Spanish American independence, Puerto Rico and Cuba, and particularly Cuba, is going to fade away. Cuba does not go down a path of independence in the early 19th century, and it's in many ways the result of the Haitian Revolution that took place just years before revolutions broke out in Spanish America. So in the case of Haiti, the conditions for slaves were particularly harsh. The average life expectancy was only 4 years for imported African slaves. It's also one of the wealthiest colonies in the Americas, or most lucrative colonies for the plantation owners, and it's the largest sugar producer. Now, the fact that this is an economy so dependent on slavery and so dependent on ideas that are not republican and not liberal, relying on slavery in an imperial system, terrifies elites in other slave societies such as Cuba, Puerto Rico, and Brazil, and as a result, removes all three of these colonies, or the elites from these three colonies, from Wars of Independence in the early 19th century. Now, the third important external cause are the Napoleonic Wars in Europe. French armies invade Portugal and Spain in 1807 and 1808, and this causes two important political shifts in Portugal and Spain. So Prince João VI flees Portugal to Brazil, so he uproots his kingdom, or so the political power of his kingdom, and moves it to Rio de Janeiro. And as a result, Portuguese monarchical power is uninterrupted by these Napoleonic Wars. But as a result, Portuguese control of Brazil is very much entrenched because the Portuguese king moves to Brazil during these Napoleonic Wars. At the same time, the Spanish king, Ferdinand VII, is forced to abdicate the Spanish throne, and he's replaced by Napoleon's brother. Now, this has an immediate impact on Spanish-American independence. There are other factors over the course of the 19th century, but it's the spark, that's the invasions of the Iberian Peninsula by France, that sparks a political reorganization or sort of new political discussions in Spanish America. And most specifically, it causes elites in Spanish colonies to debate whether they should remain colonies of a French-imposed king or govern in the name of a deposed king. And that's the beginning of a process of self-governance that very quickly turns into a process of desiring full independence and entire self-control and autonomy from European political power. To my third point is the road to independence itself. So as I mentioned already, Portuguese political authority remains in many ways absolute because the power of the kingdom is transferred from Lisbon to Rio de Janeiro during the Napoleonic Wars. And one important outcome of that is that slavery continues throughout the 19th century. There's not a rupture caused by these wars of independence in the nature of the Brazilian political and economic system in the same way it is in other parts of, in Spanish America. In the case of Spain, there's a crisis of legitimacy for the new Spanish king, Joseph I, who is the brother of Napoleon. Peninsular and Creole elites, so Spanish-born or Spanish-descended people in the Americas, living in the viceroyalties, create a new site of political representation called cabildos, or town councils. And in these cabildos are important places for the beginnings of Spanish-American republicanism and democracy. They begin to rule in the name of legitimate king of Spain, Ferdinand VII, and therefore sort of ignoring the power of this newly imposed king of Spain, Joseph I. So it's through these cabildos that there's this beginning of political organization, which is the elite's first taste of political control at the very end of the colonial period. Now, there are clashes between Creoles and Peninsulars, clashes between the American-born and European-born people about how far to take their self-government and how much they should rule for themselves or how much they should rule in the name of Spain. In Mexico, for example, Peninsulars, Spanish-born people, strongly oppose the idea of ruling in the name of the deposed king. There's strong opposition to sort of such a disruptive idea, even if the king is not legitimate. They should not be. It's even more illegitimate to rule in the name of a king who is not the king, is the idea, this conservative idea that is particularly embraced by Mexican elites, in particular by Spanish-born elites living in Mexico. In Buenos Aires, a seat of another viceroyalty, Creoles, the American-born people, have rapid success. And in fact, it's places more on the fringes of Spanish America, so both what is modern-day Argentina or modern-day Colombia and Venezuela, these newer viceroyalties, these places that are less important for the Spanish political project, colonial project, is where the ideas of independence are more embraced. And in places that are more dependent on an imperial system, so both Peru and Mexico, those are the places where both Spanish-born and American-born Creoles are less interested in changing the political way things are, the way things are done politically. Independence, these elites realize or fear, would transform the social order and economic order of their societies, And as a result, they're less interested in embarking on projects of independence. So there's a fear of an indigenous or slave revolt in places, an indigenous revolt in places like Mexico and Peru. And as a result, elites, even those born in the Americas, are less interested in going down the path of independence. So elites in places like Buenos Aires and Caracas stood to benefit far more from free trade and had less to lose by uprooting some system of slavery or exploitative labor relations, and as a result, were more eager to take advantage of the opportunity of gaining more political autonomy from Spain. Across the Americas, in the armies and in the movements for independence, or across Spanish America, there's an appeal to the Americanness of the people, and it's a key part of their revolutionary success. So popular sovereignty, or governing for themselves rather than being a colony of Spain, and being born in the Americas become linked ideas. And it's the Americans against the Spaniards. Everyone who is born in the Americas can unite despite racial and class differences vis-a-vis these Spanish colonizers. And so it gave the Creoles, which is just a group of Spanish descended people, a big upper hand against the Peninsulars, another group of sort of Spaniards in the Americas, because it united indigenous, African, and mixed race people behind white Creole leadership. It was an important strategy to win independence, and yet changing social inequalities was not a central goal of these Creole patriots. So while there are some important social inequalities that are lessened as a result of the Wars of Independence, particularly in terms of the end of slavery, equality for all people born in the Americas, in Spanish America, is not the thing driving the Wars of Independence, but is a strategy in the Wars of Independence to unite a diverse population under Creole leadership. My fourth point on the key ideas, leaders, dates, and outcomes. So a few key takeaways from Spanish American independence. There are some important figures in these wars of independence. Simón Bolívar is perhaps the most famous of the liberators or leaders of these wars of independence. He was actually joined, though, by another important Venezuelan or person from the viceroyalty of New Granada, Antonio José de Sucre. Bolívar has a country, Bolivia, named after him. The capital of that country is Sucre. These are two important leaders from northern South America. The important leader from southern South America is named José de San Martín from Argentina. And it's these two armies led by Bolívar and Sucre in the north and San Martín in the south that work their way south and west and north and unite in Peru and impose independence on a reluctant elite in Peru. In the case of Mexico, that their wars of independence take place sort of separately from this broader South American War of Independence. In the case of Mexico, the important leaders are Miguel Hidalgo and José María Morelos. They are both priests, and that's another important distinction between the way the Mexican Wars of Independence take place compared to how compared to under this military leadership of Bolívar, Sucre, and San Martín across South America. So as I said, the northern armies from New Granada, from Venezuela and Colombia, meet the southern armies from Argentina and Uruguay in Peru and enforce independence on a hesitant local elite in Peru. And that's how these wars of independence, these military campaigns, take place in the 1810s and 1820s. A really important outcome of these wars of independence is that slavery is abolished in all new republics. Not necessarily the day the wars are over, but within about 10 or 15 years across Spanish America, by about 1830, there is no slavery in these former Spanish colonies. New Republican citizenship is being shaped by new ideas of liberalism in which slavery cannot continue. It's in fact quite a ideological sort of aberration that the liberal republic of the United States continues to have slavery up until the 1860s. It's an idea that's the reason there's a lot of tension over this is because it's such an aberration to these liberal Republican ideals that are developing across the Americas around 1800. And in the immediate aftermath of wars of independence in Spanish America, that sort of contradiction is fixed in abolishing slavery. In the places that don't want to abolish slavery, they do not embark on the path of liberal republicanism, such as Cuba or Puerto Rico or Brazil. In the United States, though, it sort of stands out as a country that very much goes down the path of liberal republicanism while also having this thing that is a total violation of the key principles of liberal republicanism, which is slavery. So independence required the military pacts between Creoles, indigenous, African, and mixed-race peoples, and then that's an important reason why slavery is abolished in these new Spanish-American republics. Free trade is another central policy of the new republics, and it's in that the frustration with not having free trade before the Wars of Independence started was an important motivator for Creole elites to, in fact, embark on wars of independence or to throw off Spanish colonial rule, because they were being constrained of who they could trade with, and goods produced in Spanish America could only be traded with Spain. These new republics are somewhat democratic. They broaden the political representation to a group of landowning white male elites, and that's sort of broadening from the previous colonial system. And these wars of independence become foundational fictions for the nation states that develop over the course of the 19th century. So a nation is not really born in the Wars of Independence, but 80 years later, the republics and the citizens of those, what are now increasingly calling themselves nations, see those wars of independence as an important step in the creation of those nations. So there's the independence takes place at a similar time across Spanish America, with the exceptions of places that do not embark on wars of independence. So Argentina declares or sort of solidifies its independence in 1816, Mexico in 1821, Colombia in 1819, Peru in 1824. It's all in this very narrow time period. The four dates I just listed are all between 1816 and 1824. Countries from Argentina, Mexico, Colombia, and Peru, sort of across Spanish America, independence is achieved. Two places where independence is not achieved and two places where slavery persists until the 1880s. Is Brazil. So there's the Portuguese king returns to Portugal in 1822 and then leaves, creates a new thing, which is basically a perpetuation of the colonial imperial system. And the empire of Brazil is created with the son of the Portuguese king as the emperor. That's found in 1822. So there's a bit of a similar timeline with independence in Spanish America, but it's not a republic in the same way. And the end of the empire of Brazil takes place in 1889, right around the same time as the end of the Spanish colony of Cuba in 1898. And in both of those, in that Empire of Brazil and the Spanish colony of Cuba, slavery persists in the 1880s. So what were four Spanish viceroyalties become more than four republics in the 1820s. And within about a decade, some of those republics are fractured further into what are now the countries we know today. So, for example, Colombia starts off in the 1820s as a single A country in the 1820s starts off calling itself Colombia. Historically now it's referred to as Greater Colombia or Gran Colombia. And then in the 1830, Venezuela, Ecuador, and Colombia all emerge out of what was a bigger country. Similarly, in the 1830s, the United Provinces of Central America is a country up until the 1830s, and then Guatemala, Nicaragua, Honduras, and El Salvador all are created in the ashes of this sort of failed federal system. And finally, the United Provinces of the Rio de la Plata, the original name in 1816 for what becomes Argentina and Uruguay, also fracture, and Uruguay splits off into being its own republic. So the local interests, a lack of consensus about how to build a federal republic leads to the breakdown of some of these initial regional alliances and then gives way to, by the 1830s, smaller, a more fractured landscape of Spanish American republics. So to conclude, I started with talking about Spanish America as a very Eurocentric and limited way of even talking about the war, or the point of departure for wars of independence. Spanish America in 1790 was still a very indigenous place with only limited Spanish economic, political, and military control. And so any map you see of a viceroyalty and then any aspiration you would see of a post-independent mega republic of one or four republics is building on a very Eurocentric idea in which a map drawn by a map maker, either in Spain or in a capital city of a viceroyalty, betrays the reality on the ground in which Spanish colonial power is limited. Now, the American, French, and Haitian revolutions all influenced the wars of independence and the ideas of independence in Spanish America. And then also, particularly the Haitian Revolution, influenced the lack of independence in other parts of the Americas, particularly Cuba, Puerto Rico, and Brazil. So it's not embracing the end of slavery, which is something seen as a result of this revolutionary Atlantic, and particularly the Haitian Revolution, also plays an important role in the paths taken or paths not taken in these wars of independence in the early 19th century. Now, finally, the interest of local white elites born in the Americas, so these Creoles, and their interest in gaining power is what drove these movements for these wars of independence, and they successfully united a diverse population of indigenous, African, and mixed race heritage under their leadership, under this banner of Americanness vis-a-vis peninsular colonial power, and successfully led these wars of independence.